Good afternoon. You have tuned in to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced here at the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX. I am Stephen DeLuque, and today we continue with our December storytelling series. Both Krissa and I have chosen an important object that has had a great emotional importance in our life. I'm going to start out first. Here we go. The subject of my story is not so much about the object itself, but more about the circumstances of its acquisition. In 1995, my father mentioned that he would like to visit Hawaii one last time. My father's parents had immigrated to Hawaii from Spain in 1912. They were the last family selected for the 48-day voyage because my grandfather's hands were not calloused enough for the common laborer's positions being sought. So my grandfather and grandmother and their seven children, the youngest just 2 weeks old, boarded the cargo ship for the voyage around Cape Horn to a new future. It was soon discovered that my grandfather was a fine furniture maker, and he was then hired to do the cabinetry and fine carpentry in the Dole executives' homes. This was in Waialua, on the north shore of Oahu, at that time the largest city on the island. My father had very fond memories of his early childhood and had traveled back to Oahu whenever he could. I decided that I would grant his wish and take him back for what turned out to be his penultimate visit to his favorite spot. I rented a small house several blocks from the beach that sat up on a hill overlooking the ocean, just to the east of Waialua City proper. We spent a couple of days exploring the island and eating great food from the roadside food trucks. We spent the entire day exploring Honolulu, the museums, the King Kamehameha Palace, and the profusion of luxuriant parks. My husband Jeff and I always purchase masks whenever we travel, preferably crafted by local indigenous artists. I was surprised to discover that the native Hawaiians never covered their faces so that they would not be covering up their facial tattoos. I started scouting for other forms of native artworks and ran across a remarkable carving. It was of a traditional tiki figure in a squatting position with a classic snarl adorning his face. But the most appealing feature was the material from which it was made. The tiki had been carved from the nose bone of a swordfish. It was surprisingly heavy, weighing almost 5 pounds. It wasn't a mask, but surely a carving of a face would suffice. My dad and I spent the last few days wandering the beaches. Actually, I wandered the beaches while he sat in the shade. It was the longest time that the two of us had spent together. He related stories of his childhood and of his young adulthood in Cuba, Peru, and the Philippines. He asked me about my life and my interests. I had always loved my father, but now I had discovered what a kind and caring man he was. The trip to Hawaii with him gave a new perspective on how truly remarkable he was. My father was to make one more trip to Hawaii. My father died in 2005, and on what would have been his 100th birthday, his five children gathered on the beach at Waialua and shared his ashes with the land, the sand, and the sea. The carved swordfish tiki occupies an honored place in our home, and every time I pick it up, I am reminded of that memorable week I spent with one of the most amazing men.
Hi, I'm Ears on Art co-host Krissa Hewitt. My story is about my grandmother. The object is a framed set of three large sand dollars that used to hang, unframed, on the inside of her front door of her winter home. They were a gift, not something to be found on her Connecticut coast. I was only in that house a few times, as our visits were to the house at the shore. My sister remembered the shells, and when our grandmother died, asked if she could have them. Can't remember when they came to me, but I see them every morning when I wake up and look across the room. My father was born in Connecticut, and our summer vacation ritual was to travel cross-country, by train or car, to visit his family. This included his sister and his mother, who was the only grandparent I met, the other three dying before I was around. My aunt and uncle owned a summer house on the shore in Niantic, Connecticut. This was our home away from home. Grandma was born in 1877, so by the time I met her in the 1950s, she was in her 70s. My memory bank encompasses my years, 3 to 8, during our week-long summer visits. In 1956, our stay was over 2 months due to my father becoming ill and dying close to his place of birth. In an almost storybook way, Helen Sanford Hewitt performed the grandmother part perfectly. She was the vessel of all things nurturing, a fawning over whatever objects I presented to her from my exploration on the beach, or a willingness to play Go Fish or other card games while discreetly cheating so as to keep me involved until someone or something else attracted my attention and set her free, or eating the 1 or 2 bite meal prepared by my father of the very small fish I had caught with him that day, or sending us off to Mystic Seaport with crisp dollar bills she believed needed for purchasing souvenirs, usually an assortment of stick candy, or in the early morning from her room at the end of the hall, beckoning me to come and climb in bed so she could tell me stories, thus keeping me from disturbing my parents and others for whom 6:30 was far too early to be up. Those morning moments were special. She told me stories of sleigh rides, being huddled under wool blankets pulled up to your chin to fend off the cold of the snow-covered ground. Her fingers manipulated the air as she talked, painting in the details. For me, as a native of the San Fernando Valley, stories of real winter were spellbinders. Other tales often included my father as a child, always doing something that from her perspective was remarkable. But invariably, the bedtime sessions also included some talk or observation of nature. We would spot and watch the travels of the spider on the ceiling and wonder where the journey would take it. I don't remember her ever expressing fear that a bite of our flesh was its destination. Nature was her love. The chair with umbrella affixed was permanently positioned on the lawn on the west side of the house. Here she would sit overlooking the secluded section of the Long Island Sound, where she could take in the never-ending rhythm of the water and enjoy the evening ritual of the setting sun. Yes, it was the Atlantic, and we were facing west, and the sun did set over the water. It was on the sand and boulder-filled area below that I would spend time during the day collecting shells and other treasures for her to exclaim over. Cunning was her favorite adjective, meaning small, adorable, precious. Prolific on this section of the Connecticut shore were slipper shells or boat shells, so unscientifically named due to their shape. The rocky coast meant little of size survived the wave action, but she loved whatever I brought forth. Unlike California, Connecticut has seasons. Her birthday was in March, which meant she could welcome another year with the arrival of budding leaves and flowers. There was a yellow flower that told of her spring's arrival. Leaves, months later, would turn red, yellow, and orange. One fall, she sent me an envelope of this colored collection. We used them as dinner table decor more than once. They kept their color, and I admired them for years. One summer, she, my aunt, and cousin stayed in the house during a hurricane, bracing the second-story windows with a sheet of plywood to keep the wave water out of the bedroom. My grandmother's story was focused on the subsequent phenomenon of being in the bright sunshine of the eye, as momentarily everything seemed beautiful and serene. There were many repetitive events at the shore, but one of her favorites was the daily short walk to the pond to feed the ducks the day-old bread. This served two important functions, not wasting anything and enjoying nature. As I gaze at the sand dollars, I become aware of the imprint this woman bestowed on her very young granddaughter. She took in her world with a keen eye. Her wisdom stemmed from observation, not books. With this knowledge, she gave without fanfare. She taught me to look below the surface, that place where treasure is often discovered. Christmas presents always had things tucked inside a pocket or elsewhere, favorite candy or sometimes a silver dollar. Her stories were always about the details. If she needed a break from us, she took one by removing herself. I have no memory of her being unavailable to those in her presence. She certainly had opinions, but speaking negatively was not her mode of operation. I knew she was old by the white hair, the hearing aids that were a real source of irritation, and the heavy, corrective black shoes. The repetition that was so much a part of the daily activities of those visits has helped implant my awareness of the wisdom embedded in this smart, gracious, generous woman. She travels with me often, for which I am most honored and grateful. When the instruction is not delivered by hammer, it is possible to not instantly know of or appreciate what was taught. My physical time with my grandma encompasses less than 5 months, but her teachings have served as a metronome for my first 7 decades and whatever comes next. It was April 1999 when Ears on Art first went on air. Fortunately for us, it was not a joke. There are several to thank for that. Number one, when the then program manager Guy Rathbun was approached about putting a program about the visual arts on the radio, he believed it could work. The list is long of the things he did to give us instruction about recording and editing a radio show. The program owes its existence to his trust and guidance. The original crew consisted of Bill Beeson, Karen Kyle, Gail Johnson, and me. Programs were recorded here at KCBX. Going out to studios happened about a year or more later and changed everything. Original hosts took their leave, and to my good fortune, Stephen, you agreed to become a partner in this adventure.
Yes, perhaps therapy would have been a better answer to that question. But it's been an incredible, enjoyable experience through all of these years. And those original programs were done live. Talk about terrifying.
Yes, there was a lot of hand-waving. Time to start, time to stop. Now you're in, now you're out. So that was a little...
harrowing.
It was actually, again, Guy Rathbun who started the on-site recordings because he took upon himself to go to the dedication of 2 outdoor sculptures on the creek. It was an event that happened one day, and I was teaching, and he learned about it and just went and did it and said, maybe you can use this.
Yeah, it was remarkable once we had the ability to travel to out-of-studio locations and to record artists in their studios and to visit faraway places. Chris, you've done interviews in Italy, and we've done them in Los Angeles, and I did one in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's been quite something. And working for an NPR affiliate station opened a few doors. I know people were always very generous, but I would give that as the lead-in to give some sense of authenticity to what I was about to do. But certainly the recordings in Italy with the marble carvers that I was learning from, I don't speak Italian, and it was such a wonderful way to get to know them better, as I would be part of these interviews with the program director who would translate. We all got closer because of it.
And we also were able to establish friendships and professional associations with some fairly remarkable people. Julia Child was delight when we went down to interview her, and the interview with Jerome Witkin set up years-long association with the gallery owner, Jack Rutberg.
Yes, that was all in L.A., and it was very exciting to be able to do that. Jack was so supportive and used our interview on a CD and a book that they put together of one of the Witkin exhibits. So more importantly than that little bit of fame was the chance to get to know these people.
Absolutely. And the local people, too, that allowed us the privilege of coming into their lives and to explore their creative processes. And they were all incredibly generous in sharing their experiences with us.
It's really dawned on me what a learning experience this has been, not in terms of how to do a radio program. I mean, that was definitely one of them. But really in terms of so much more about the creative process. We have so many stereotypes, I think, especially in this country, about who can be an artist and the genes that you have to be born with and all the other kind of stuff that gets put out there. And we could talk with people working in just about every medium imaginable, and they all have the same kinds of issues.
And they also have the same kind of drive, that the focus of their artwork is a way of expressing who they are and what they want to say, and they can't do it in any other way.
And can't imagine not doing it, mm-hmm. but that they also get stuck in their ideas or techniques or whatever it is that gets in the way sometimes. It was just so affirming to be hearing that and knowing that one's not alone when those things happen, even though you feel it.
And even world-famous artists admit to occasionally hitting a brick wall, and how you would overcome that was somewhat different for all of them, but there was a commonality.
We were talking about people who help get us started, and it's really important to make sure that we acknowledge the whole KCBX staff. Marisa Waddell came through with something called the insert silence button. It allows us to insert silence and give people a chance to, or a simulation that they've had a chance to breathe. It's just been our favorite little device. And Hank Hadley, boy, more than once, whether I'm or Stephen is here on a weekend and nobody else is around, he's been on the other end of the phone, or he'll come in and help us figure out something, and would have been stuck on many occasions without him.
And he helps willingly and without question and generously. I mean, the man has been absolutely amazing in his support of our program, and we deeply, deeply appreciate everything he has done for us.
Couldn't have said it better. And of course, none of this would mean anything if it weren't for all of you out there listening. We can sit in this little room and have no idea whether it's 2 or 2,000. We have learned that people that we don't know at all now know us by our voices.
It's always been a bit of a shock to me when people will come up to me in a grocery store or something and say, I know that voice.
Yes, both of us have had that happen, and I go, whoa.
I think we have more than just 4 or 5 listeners, as we usually suppose.
I think part of supposing that is that even though you're not sitting in front of us, it's a little less nerve-wracking to not be thinking about the eyes staring back as we are fumbling through our way of editing and doing the things that we have to do. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
It's impossible to express the level of gratitude that we have for the years and years of support from our listeners. We know you're out there, and we feel the love, and we want you to know that we've deeply appreciated every minute of you staying with us.
Probably as you have surmised, this is our sign-off program. I am amazed that the tears are not flowing. They have been for weeks since we've made this decision. For the moment, I guess I'm sort of calm. But we'd love to hear from you still. If you wish to comment on this program, you could send an email, which I will share with Stephen, if you send it to C. Hewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T, at calpoly.edu.
Thank you again. We'll miss you all. Hope you don't miss us too much. But we're on to another life's adventures. And another thank you to Marshall's Jewelers, who has been a sponsor for this program for years. In case you haven't heard, Marshall's is closing its doors after 129 years in business. And don't be sad. Jeff and I, who own Marshall's Jewelers, are on to our next adventure of traveling the world and expanding our horizons.
Over 100 years doesn't quite compare with 19 and a half, but you weren't doing it the whole 100 either, so.
Although at times it seemed like it.
Yes. Anyway, all, thank you for your generosity of letting us come and talk with you, the various artists around the county. For those of you tuning us in and letting us know that it's meant something to you, it has certainly meant something to both of us.
Good luck to all of you. Good life. May you experience happiness in everything that you do. You have been listening to Ears on Art, produced here at the studios of KCBX, listener-supported public radio. I am Stephen DeLuque.
And I am Chrissy Hewitt. Together, we have been bringing you this program for 19-plus years. And this is our goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much.